Ready?
Good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to tonight's August 2nd, 2021 City Council meeting. If you'd all please rise. Flag's over here now. For a short private invocation, asking for God's blessing upon this city and wisdom for our City Council as they make its decisions tonight. Now, if you'll please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please be seated. Item 1D is roll call on our meeting tonight. I wanted to check Maria Casada. Were you able to call? Maria? Okay. Absent tonight is Maria Casada and Mark Snyder. I'd entertain a motion to excuse those council members from our meeting tonight.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Let's move to our citizen input, item 1E. Tonight, is there any residents or citizens who'd like to address the City Council? Okay, hearing none, I'll move to the approval of our agenda.
Make that motion.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Let's move to our consent agenda, item 3.
Make a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Now, as we move along the agenda to our current business, item 4A is a public hearing about lot coverage and lot sizes. And I'd like to open this public hearing at 6:32 p.m.
And I, Angel Garza, will recuse myself from item 4A, public hearing, lot coverage and lot size.
Okay. Conflict of interest?
Conflict of interest.
Thank you. And as Angel Garza steps down from the dais, we have with us tonight our Community Development Director, Ann Henning. Ann, do you want to lead us in this discussion?
Thank you. So we've talked about this a little bit in the past. I introduced it, I believe it was maybe not last meeting, but recently. The Planning Commission has been discussing this for a bit. The Housing Action Plan suggested looking at lot coverage and lot sizes as a way to increase the efficiency of how the land can be used, so that we have enough land and utilities to provide housing. So provided for you the Planning Commission's recommendations. Second page is just like a summary. So reducing the lot sizes in all the zones and increasing the lot coverage in all the zones with different, more lot coverage, so higher density in higher density zones. The 35% lot coverage that's existing started in 1950 in the first zoning ordinance when Othello had 526 people, I believe it was. Obviously, a lot has changed in that time since then. And so it's come up as an issue in multiple projects just this year, the lot coverage issue. People aren't being able to do with their lots what they would like to be able to do with them. So that was the impetus that brought it to the Planning Commission. And then lot coverage and lot size kind of go together. You have to look at them hand in hand. I guess I would answer any questions.
How did we come up with the 50% from the 35% on R1 through 1 and 2, and then, of course, the 65? Where did we come from when we derived those numbers?
So I showed some samples, and those are on the Planning Commission agenda, the last Planning Commission agenda, samples of what people were proposing and what 35% lot coverage looks like now, none of the things that have been proposed were as high as 50%. There was one that was approved that was 50%. It's kind of a long story, but that was an error in the past that was allowed to continue the way it was. I think that was just to give a lot of flexibility. I don't think you'll actually see much in the way of 50% lot coverage, especially in R1, where all you can do is single family. But yeah, I don't know that there was a specific reason for that number.
Okay.
Maybe. Chris Dorr, okay.
Did you want to make comment, Chris?
I do. As to the question, it's very important. When we looked at this, one of the things that we wanted to look at, one of the things we always look at, is what is the rest of Washington State like? Are we consistent? Or are we an outlier? Sometimes we want to be an outlier. But in this case, being an outlier prevented people from putting patios on their house. That's a problem. Another problem is our housing shortage. And this created an opportunity to make more affordable housing in this community. That's what's needed. And that is consistent with the same policy, with the same practices throughout the states. Most cities in Washington State have 50% lot coverage on most of their lots. I also wanted to point out in R4 where it says no restrictions, that doesn't mean there's no restrictions. There's other code in place that has to be followed, but it allows for more density to be built easier and quicker. But it allows somebody to actually put a patio in their backyard. And we had 11 people last year who weren't allowed to do that with our current system. It was too restrictive. We made a mistake when we did it. And this is to fix that mistake.
Thank you, Chris. So then I take that to mean that this isn't just for new, the lot coverage is for existing too. So we could potentially have 20 applications or requests for building permits once we adopt this?
We could. The patio covers that Dr. Dorr referenced were existing houses where they were already pretty close to their lot coverage, and so they wanted to add a patio cover in their backyard. They weren't able to make it as big as they wanted to. They wanted to go the width of the house, and even like going 8 feet out the width of the house, it was just exceeded the lot coverage.
Good.
You know, I don't know that people are like waiting in the wings for this to pass to apply, but there are actually a couple of triplex permits that are, as submitted, I think it was 36 or 37% lot coverage, and so they are waiting to see if this passes before they would redesign the project if it doesn't pass.
Okay.
So those people that were unable to put in their patios or patio covers, are we going to contact them to let them know?
They all chose to move forward with a smaller patio cover. That, yeah.
All right, thank you, Ann. At this time, I'll open the public testimony. Is there anyone here who would like to speak with regard to the lot sizes being changed and the lot coverage being increased? Hearing none. Oh, yes. Chris Dorr.
Chris Dorr, Chairman of the Planning Commission. I just wanted to make kind of a public statement how much I appreciated the input we got from the public all the way around on this. We got some great support, great ideas. We went through a process. This was not where I thought it was going to end up, but somebody had a better idea than I had in mind, and this is where we ended up. And we got there because we had a lot of smart people in the room who really had a lot of good suggestions. So I really want to thank the public of Othello for the help they gave us in this recommendation.
Thank you. Any other testimony? Okay, I'll close the public testimony. And council, do you need any additional information? And I'll close this public hearing at 6:40 p.m. and ask for a motion to approve or deny or approve with conditions or to continue this public hearing or to continue this discussion.
So this is it's making a motion to adopt ordinance 1569 amending the current ordinance that's in play. Related to lot coverage, well, there's one other change. It was in the ordinance that was struck out, the 900-foot square foot site area plus 300 landscaping. Do we need to talk about that or just?
So that was part of the lot size. And so that was additional area that was added onto your base lot size. And so I felt like that was just, that was part of lot size. And so that's why I struck that out. I know that that was specifically discussed by the Planning Commission as something that needed to come out of the ordinance. So it'd still be required.
I'm in favor of that.
Okay. So landscaping still required, parking still required. It's just not adding additional lot area to accommodate those things. They're having to fit it onto the lot that they have.
Yeah, it can't really fit in there with the change in sizes and the percentage of use. Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. Well, I read the motion, and I would like to make the motion.
I'll second your motion.
The first motion, there's two of them.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, excuse me.
No, there isn't.
There isn't two motions. It's
there's
to
only
adopt
a single
this,
motion.
Amend this, yep. So we have a motion made and second to amend our OMC. Related to lot coverage and lot size. Is there any further discussion? Council, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you. Now, Angel Garza is going to rejoin us on the dais. And we're going to move to item 4B. Accessory dwelling unit introduction. And Ann, you had this discussion with the Planning Commission?
I did.
Yes.
So we've talked a lot about accessory dwelling units over the years. I think maybe there's been some change in how people are thinking about it. And so the Planning Commission had wanted to bring back their recommendation to the council. It was pre-COVID. They wanted to wait for the big zoning update to be adopted by the council. They didn't want to throw that at you while you were still looking at that zoning update. That took quite a while. Wanted to wait for what happened with the legislature in spring of 2020. And then it was COVID, and Planning Commission really wanted to present it in a study session and not just forward a recommendation. And so they had been waiting for being able to meet in person again. So we're at that point, finally. So the Planning Commission did discuss it again at their last meeting. They made a few changes to their recommendation. And I know Christora wanted to talk to you about that a little bit. But so we're not asking for any approvals at this point. What we're asking for is direction. Would you like to have a study session with the Planning Commission? Would you like to set a public hearing? Kind of. Where should we go with accessory dwelling units, since that has been kind of a hot topic?
My turn for the recommendations.
Chris Doro, Chairman of the Planning Commission, again. So on this one, to further explain where the commission went, the commission looked at this and we decided, based on staff recommendations, that we've already gone through the public hearing process. So we went ahead and had made the changes into the ADU recommendation that we previously sent to you, and we passed it unanimously. And I'm going to go through what those changes are, and then I put it back to the council to either go forward with the process to change this ordinance, or I guess to send it back to us to reevaluate. But if we go forward to what's being recommended.
The draft?
The ordinance.
Want to bring up the draft?
The draft ordinance. It has pretty much the same, it's pretty much the same draft ordinance we had as far as the building goes, the requirements for parking, all of that has remained the same. The changes that we made in it, if you go to the next page, right there, because we considered that there may be a change in lot coverage and definitions of ADUs. An ADU is not a duplex, and our building commissioner made this very clear to us in our meeting that by definition they're very different. So therefore they should have some different consideration in how they're put together and how they're built. With that in mind, we thought it was consistent with intent to change number L on the ordinance, which wasn't there before, with a maximum size of an ADU of 900 square feet and a capacity of no more than 2 bedrooms. The problem here is parking. We want to make sure there's adequate room for parking. We want to make sure it's out of the way. We want to make sure all the other building requirements which we have put forward can be done. The thing we feared is a little tiny house in front and a gigantic ADU behind. That's probably not aesthetically pleasing and might create some problems. So that was the first change we made from our original ordinance from before. The other change is owner occupancy. These would be allowed without owner occupancy in zones R4 and R3. R2 has been a bone of contention for what to do with it. And to that end, we stole something from the contractor's rules that state if you're a contractor and you build a house and live in it for a year and then sell it, you can do so as a contractor. You can take all the advantages that are given to you as a contractor to do that. If you stay over for that, you pay a pretty significant penalty because to build as a contractor, you can do it much cheaper than to build on your own. So to that end, we changed owner occupancy to be something, I think, a little bit more manageable and a little more consistent with intent of what we want to do. Ultimately, in R2, please keep in mind, I'm not sure we want to prevent people from being able to build accessory dwellings for their family. And the makeup of this community, that's a significant concern. People want to build, want a place for mom and dad, but don't necessarily want them in their house. Or they might want a place for their adult children who aren't quite ready to go out on their own yet. Or even if they want to use their own property to make a little bit of extra money, I'm not sure that's something we want to stand in the way of. We are concerned, however, if somebody owns 60 houses and unmitigatingly creates a residential subdivision. That's probably something we don't want. So to that end, yes.
Let me ask you a question on something you just said. So the owner occupancy, first of all, that's not enforceable. There's no way you're going to be able to enforce that. Second of all, isn't that part of why the last ordinance that we created was challenged in court?
I don't believe it was challenged in court.
Was it challenged in court?
Yeah, it's never been challenged in court.
Okay, why was it challenged in court, the last ordinance?
It was not challenged in court.
We did it incorrectly, procedurally.
Yeah.
I voted on it when it was a 3-3 tie, and the mayor can't decide an ordinance. It has to be the council.
That's why. Yeah, it had nothing to do with it. But you're right. It's complicated to do this. You know, so to have an owner occupancy like we had in before, even though that is consistent with a lot of ordinances throughout the state, it's tough. It's a tough thing to do. I'm not sure, though, that that's what we want to do. Like I said, the concern we have is somebody basically making a residential subdivision within R2. That you don't want somebody who owns 60 houses adding an ADU to the backyard without notifying the people who are going to do it, and then surprise, because you're going to have a line outside here that's going to be pretty significant. That's going to be a problem.
But if, even if there's not an owner occupancy, they have to license it as a rental with
correct.
The city.
And this is where the one-year time really comes into play here on this. But more importantly than anything, with this owner occupancy of you have to be in it for 1 year, it allows our building inspector, it allows Ann a lot better position to manage and monitor that situation, so we don't have, like I said, somebody with 60 houses adding 60 ADUs to it and creating the problems it could create. But also give the opportunity for the individual to use their property in a way that can help their family or help themselves. The one-year time period, the thing that I liked about it, I'll give you my personal opinion, is that it puts everyone on a level playing field. If you were renting a house and all of a sudden your landlord said, hey, I'm building something in the backyard, that could create some problems. On the other hand, if you rent an ADU that's built by the owner and you rent it, whether he sells that and then rents the place out or decides to rent the place out a year later, at least the person in the ADU is on equal footing, knows what the score is beforehand. And they're not going to be lined up here waiting to have a discussion with why you guys did that. We found this as the best way to manage our biggest concern, but still give opportunity in R2. And that's why we made that change. I know it's challenging, but it works very well with the contractor license, and we thought it was applicable to our situation for what we're trying to accomplish while still addressing some of our housing needs and kind of a better managed, a better intent and create a little less problem.
So when we were discussing this before, we were talking about regulating this with zoning, but if you're going to allow it now in R2, 3, 4, et cetera, there's really no, I mean, there's R1 is the only
R1's is not allowed in. Yeah. R3 and 4 would mean you could add them without owner occupancy. It wouldn't have that regulation. But keep in mind, we also designated R3 and 4 for higher densities. Also keep in mind, R2 does allow duplexes, so there is some understanding that there can be some increased density. But again, I think when you look at the possibility and this community in particular, And it's been a great time to have some changes on our planning commission to give us some different perspective on how important it is having something for extended family. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard, I'd like a place for mom and dad if I can. Right now, we're not really offering that. And I think this fix addresses a lot of our concerns while still giving that opportunity.
Okay. So I'm sure we'll have more discussion about that.
As far as for what we're looking for the Planning Commission, we voted on this. We accepted this. So it is to you all to decide if you want to move forward through your capacity or send it back to us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Unless you guys have any other questions for me.
No, I don't.
Right Thank now. You.
Oh, yes, I do. Okay, so yes, no. One of the things, and I talked about that with you last weekend. So we have the original dwelling, and then we have this ADU in the back that's now been built or is already there. Is the requirement still that there has to be a sidewalk come up the side of the house
yes.
of the original dwelling so that people who want to deliver a package or whatever still has access to that house, not from the alley? Is that
and
correct?
It has to be clearly marked. And more importantly, it really needs to be okay with the emergency access. The emergency access is the most critical aspect. But yes, everything you said needs to also be part of that. And it is...
Item C.
Is it C?
Yep.
Yeah, it is in C of that concern. If you'd like, I can go through it again, but this is pretty much the same thing. I just highlighted the changes that were brought forward based on your all straw poll that you had and things okay. that didn't seem to work last time.
Did you guys discuss anything about, like, stock plans?
About what?
Stock plans, like three different plans are allowable to build these ADUs. Did you go there or not?
The only thing we discussed was the 900 square foot maximum four bedroom max. We you know, just like everything else, similarly to what we looked at in the R4 situation, you know, letting people have some leeway and creativity to do what fits within those rules. If we make good rules, I think we give a lot of people opportunity to do some great things.
Okay.
Is there a timeline on the conditions for legalizing the pre-existing accessory, the non-conforming? So if this was adopted, maybe that would be more of a question for Ann. How long would the non-conforming ADUs have to get up to speed before?
There isn't a timeline. You know, we're kind of working on that with the rental licensing ordinance. But this ordinance was just kind of clarifying, because the non-conforming use provisions already say if it's an existing dwelling, it can remain a dwelling. And so it's just a matter of getting them up to some of the safety standards.
So is that going to continue to be a thorn without that authority or that code to be able to push them with a timeline? Will it be one of those things that drags out and be a hindrance to code enforcement?
I don't really see this proposed ordinance as very related to that. I mean, this is addressing new construction. It does have a provision just to clarify the old ones. Okay. But
so it would be taken care of in another ordinance?
Yeah, that's already... We're already working through
okay.
that one.
So we were going to charge a $25 fee for an inspection fee for non-conforming, right? We had talked about here during COVID.
So the inspection, the rental inspection fee is $10.
And that's for only rental, not for ADUs?
For any rentals. So that would include ADUs.
So yeah, they'd have to get an inspection to get up to speed.
But a non-conforming rental is not the same inspection, would not be the same as a rental inspection, because they're going to need to go through, or is it?
It is the same, because it's the basic things that the landlord-tenant law requires as far as...
But so on these, all these non-conforming, and there's a bunch of them, mm-hmm. nobody's going through and checking foundations, nobody's going through and checking heating systems.
Heating
they're,
is one of the things that's...
They're basically going to go through and check for safety.
Well, safety and health and safety. So heating, plumbing, structural, you know, they're not checking if it has a foundation or not, but they're looking at, are there, you know, structural concerns about this building?
Spencer, go to the last paragraph. That specifically talks about non-conforming residents in existence prior to the adoption of this ordinance.
Right.
So they may be designed as a legal non-conforming residence by complying with current lifestyle standards.
So they would
be inspected, and they would be, you know, they would have to comply with a lifestyle standard.
Rental, whatever our rental housing checklist. Yeah.
So is that in effect already? And if it is, has any applied for that yet, for that inspection?
We have had about 10 or 15 applications just for rentals in general. I don't remember if any of those were ADUs. And then end of last week, we did send out letters to 65 landlords that we knew of in town. And we've gotten a few calls already today. So
you sent out 65 letters in regard to?
to people that we knew were landlords to say, we passed this ordinance for rental inspection and licensing, and here's your application, here's the process, you need to get started.
I think the rentals, I don't see that too big of a problem. I think the problem is in the ADUs, the ones that have come up here in the past few years that people just put together. So those are the ones that we should really be concentrating, that they get letters, in my opinion, so you can get up to standard.
So we identified all of the landlords that we could based on the assessor records and the utility records. So there are probably some, and just like Tim and Heather, what they know from driving around in the alleys.
We have a lot more 65 ADUs out there.
Well, that was landlords. So some of them have multiple properties. You know, I can show the list with you if you like.
I know there's, I bet there's five times that many ADUs in this town. Easily.
I want to say that ADU.
Corey's problem is he goes around the whole town.
I want to say there was about 100 or 125 on Heather's list of the old non-conforming ADUs that Tim and Heather have been working on.
So City Council, you guys have a lot of options at this, you know, at this particular time. First of all, the first thing that we need as staff is a consensus that you want to continue the discussion, or do you want to shut the discussion down?
No, no, I want to keep going. This is good. This is a good draft to work from. Yeah. You know, I don't think it needs that much more polishing. I think that where it says that there has to be off-street parking requirements. Two off-street parking spaces shall be provided for the first bedroom, and one additional off-street parking for space shall be provided for each additional bedroom. But we're already saying that there can only be two bedrooms.
So they can only have three parking spaces.
So maybe D can be combined with the paragraph that states that it's only going to have two bedrooms.
And I didn't want to make that change without knowing what the feeling was going to be on limiting it to two bedrooms.
You thought maybe one would be kept and the other one would be dropped or something?
If you didn't like that, for example, at L, you guys wanted to have more capacity, that's why we didn't make that change, because then it would become...
I don't think you want to allow more than two bedrooms because you don't want the accessory unit to be larger than the main unit.
Well, that's one thing that needs to be discussed. It's a 900 square foot max size. That's huge. That is huge for an ADU.
That's big.
Yeah. So that needs to be discussed, and the zone.
You know what, Corey? A lot of these lots that are back here, they're big lots. The mold that were developed back in the 50s, 60s.
Right.
You can put a 900 square foot home.
One of the things we can do is a percentage of the main house, percentage of the size of the main house.
Well, with the lot coverage now, you can go to where, you know, if your house is, you know, they don't have garages, the old ones. So if you have a 1,500 square foot house on a 10,000 square foot lot, you can get a 900 easy.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. But you don't want, there's also some 900 square foot houses and some 800 square foot houses in town. Why would you want to allow a 900 square foot? But that's what I'm saying. I understand that. But what I'm saying is, rather than going a max 900 square feet, you could go a percentage of the main dwelling unit. Like if you've got a 1,500 square foot house, if you go a 50%, you go 750 foot.
Well, I think it's all covered in your lot coverage, Corey. To be honest with you, that covers everything right there. Why are you going to restrict them when you have the lot, you know, we already said in the lot coverage, it's done.
Because you want to have an 800 square foot house sitting up front and 900 square foot lot.
Well, the flip side to that argument is somebody like Angel can build a 40,000 square foot ADU, and I'm being facetious, but he's going to be able to get a bigger ADU than I'm going to get. He has way more square footage than I do.
Exactly.
So I think as it's written now, 900 square foot, that's what he gets, that's what I get.
I mean,
may make a suggestion. We're talking about not allowing it in R1, and I don't think there's R2 lots that are, you know, 9,000 square feet.
I don't think it's just an R2.
Your resident R2?
Ours was two city lots.
Yeah, they were big lots.
Yeah, it's our, and we're in R4.
There's a lot of lots you can put in there.
I don't think they should be allowed in R2.
Just to add, because this was something we discussed heavily. What Corey's bringing up was something that we had two meetings of debate on. So I understand where Corey's coming, but I'd like to explain where Planning Commission came on that. What we have tried to do is try to make things as simple as possible. Because as you make things with ratios, as you increase complexity, you're increasing a lot of issues that makes. With our lot coverage, we felt that 900 square foot was very consistent with a maximum of what the intention of an ADU in any of the zones would cover. And to make it easy, making that the maximum with the two bedrooms was the best way to make it simple. And making things simple in Othello can accomplish a whole lot. I have to live by the KISS technique because I'm just not that complicated of a human. So if we can keep it simple, it works out good for me.
So what do we do with ADUs that are built in R1?
Well, there they
are. Right now they exist.
I don't think there's any. Is there any?
They're non-conforming.
But if they apply for a rental housing for $10, they get checked out, then they do comply, in a sense, because that's what that says right there.
But we're actually not allowing
it. It is illegal non-conforming.
Wouldn't be able to build new ones.
If it burnt down, they wouldn't be able to replace it.
Why wouldn't that fall under the grandfather clause? That would be like somebody having a house on a lot that is too small to build a house on. So like my lot, the lot that I own does not fit into what does it does if this passes, or yeah, it does now that we passed the ordinance. But up until then, my lot's only 6,500 square feet. So if my house would have burned down, it should have grandfathered in, correct? It should have grandfathered in. So why wouldn't an ADU be in there falling into the same circumstances?
Just
you're
not conforming.
It's not conforming. So it's existing non-conforming. The non-conforming chapter already says residential units, you know, as of 2016 can continue.
If something happened to it, then they wouldn't be able to replace it.
If they get it inspected though, it would be allowed in by the city. So. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I do. So when you talk about the legal non-conforming uses and the grandfather clause, there is quite a bit of case law on that, as you can imagine. And for me to answer that question here, I couldn't do it reliably. I have to take a look at that. And it also depends on the specific codes that we're talking about. I think this is all great discussion, and it gives me a lot of information of some things that I want to look at before this comes to council for public hearing. And those are good questions, and those are answers I'll have for you at that time.
Okay, so I think what I'd like to do is because we could go on here quite a while on this. But what I would like to do is I would like to have a joint session again with the Planning Commission like we did before, and we can discuss all these issues that the City Council has, because, you know, I mean, we're talking about the 900 square feet. Well, what about the minimum size that we're going to allow? And what about, you know, and so... These discussions, really, if we had them jointly with the Planning Commission, I think we would all benefit from that. With that, we would then come up with, like John said, maybe there's not a lot of work left to do on this accessory dwelling unit ordinance. then we would have something for Kelly to review. We could have our public hearing. We could then have another chance to hack out any changes that we think need to be done on it. And then if we do need to change it, if it ends up becoming more substantial, then we'll have to just continue the public hearing and work on it some more. But I think that's the process I'd like to follow, if you guys are all agreeable to that. So we'll include the Planning Commission and move forward.
If I could make a recommendation?
Yes.
A lot of the stuff that already has been brought up is stuff we have gone over and we could probably explain pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So if we do have a joint meeting, it could easily be done in probably in conjunction with your regular meeting. We could probably cover a lot of the concerns and explanations easily, I think, well under an hour, as opposed to having a fixed meeting.
I think
we can really knock this out pretty quickly. Some of the things that have been brought up about minimum size, there's stuff that goes with that that we've gone through that I'd love to just, boom, explain, but maybe it'd be better to do it formally with the whole commission.
Yeah, I agree. I enjoy the optimism, but this isn't going to be a short discussion. I can guarantee that.
We can make it short.
Yeah, he's right. He's right.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
I mean, I look at this and I already, like item I, minimum setback from an alley shall be 5 feet. Well, there's an easement behind my property that is where the sewer runs. And it's an open easement. And the one individual right directly behind me has built into that easement. He's built a shop. And he did get a building permit to do it, but he's taken up 5 feet of the 10-foot easement for what should have been an alley in the back of my property. So does that count as an alley? Or can I just go ahead and move my fence back 5 feet?
You can't build in an easement that I can't explain. Yeah. You know, I don't know, unless that easement isn't tracked in some way. If it's not on the plat, then we're not going to know about it.
It's on the plat.
Okay.
Because I came in and looked at it, and it's in the Flowers Edition plat that it's an easement because that's where the sewer line is. And everybody else on the pine and fir, they respect that. It's just that one guy, he's moved into the...
So it's a fence, it's in an easement? It's a fence?
No.
A building?
It's a building, it's a garage.
Well, if they ever dig that sewer out...
Well, I'll do you one better. Where we used to live up on Olympia, they abandoned the alleyways. The sewer still runs right down the middle of the backyard.
Right.
And right along the fence line. And you've got people with sheds and patios and all kinds of things built right out there in that area.
I think that's a lot where there's no alley in between, because it's the same way in my neighborhood. The sewer runs between all the houses. And
yeah, but you couldn't put an accessory dwelling unit right out in the back of the lot where there's a sewer line that runs through.
Anyway, there'll be some more discussion. I think okay, you're right,
yeah.
Sean.
This needs more discussion. The last time we've had so much discussion that I don't anticipate that this is just going to open and shut. So.
But it's good we're moving forward with it.
It needs discussed, and we're going to adopt it. We need to get something that we can completely support, or at least support substantially.
And I'd like to thank the Planning Commission for hard work and moving forward on this. That hasn't been easy. Even before I sat on council, this was a topic. So you guys have done a great job.
It's got a very challenging history. I don't envy you guys for having to go through all this.
Fair enough.
Okay. And thank you. Now I'd like to move to item 4C, law enforcement reform laws. Police Chief Phil Shank has been busy absorbing and retaining all the recent policing law changes, and he is gonna introduce us with a three-part series. So Chief,
Mayor and Council,
take it away.
Thank you. I've tried to break this into bite-sized chunks, so there's about Well, I've gone through 450 pages of this, of the bills. I did send them all to you folks, so please read them all and then let's discuss them. And if you can make sense of it, you're going to be...
I went through a lot of them today.
I'm going to get through some of it. I'm going to start with the most relevant, but let me kind of go. These are the bills that I've sent you. Mixed into what the attachment was also the timeline that WASPIC's put together. These bills were passed, and then most of them, or most of the impactful ones, they set a July 25 deadline to implement. And the Attorney General then has a year later to actually come up with model policy to fit it, but it was already it's already required that we implement it. I'm not going to go through each of these, but I want to talk about and explain to Council, there are changes. There are serious impacts to what law enforcement is going to look like in this state and the services that we can provide to our community. They titled this, you know, police reform, law and justice reform. That's what the governor, that's what the legislation are calling it. But let's walk through. So if you follow any social media, you're seeing that there's quite a bit of examples being put out by police departments all around us and across the state explaining certain types of calls and what's happened. Kennewick a few days ago had 9 police car tires slashed by a woman running around with a knife or two, and they didn't shoot her. But they also didn't shoot her with beanbag rounds, which they possess. We're going to get into why that happened. The state patrol had a pursuit over on the west, not a pursuit. They had a traffic stop. The individual turned around on the freeway and started going backwards through traffic. The state patrol disengaged and let it happen until that car crashed into somebody. Luckily, the individual that got crashed into wasn't seriously hurt, but there's a reason that the state patrol had to disengage from that. I'm going to walk through that, and it's going to take 3 meetings because there is so much content. But I want to leave a little bit of room for y'all to ask some questions. As we've gone through this, and I've gone through this, I've spent the last month going through this stuff. I have read House Bill 1310 probably 50 times. I've attended the WASPIC conference meeting forums on it, WCIA forums on it. I've gone over it with our city attorney. I've gone over it with the county prosecutor. Normally, I would have an attorney present this to you. I think that, I mean, I have a pretty good grasp of what's going on, so I'm going to present it to you. Some of the criticism or the ask right now is, why are we responding the way we are? And the number one thing that comes up, ACLU saying this, you name it, the legislators are saying it, resistance to change. Law enforcement doesn't want to change. We change every year frequently as new case law is implemented. We're used to change. Law enforcement today doesn't look anything like it did when I started. That's not the issue. Is there frustration? Yes, we're frustrated. As cops, we want to serve our community. We signed on to serve our community. I swore an oath right here to serve this community. And part of that is knowing that I could be shot tonight on my way out of the building as I serve this community. Part of that is I also know that I could have to shoot somebody during my career. I pray it never happens. 32 years, I haven't yet. I've had opportunity where I probably should have, and I got chewed out for not. I'm glad I didn't have to. One of the concerns that we have is vigilantism. I've had numerous people ask me, well, what if I do this? We're doing block watch groups where people are coming up to me and saying, well, what if I just take care of it? I'm hearing that more and more, and I believe we're going to see more and more of that thinking as we move forward, especially once you realize how bad things are with these new bills. And the final, and I'm going to say this is probably the truth of it, it's the intent of the bills, as well as the wording of these new laws, that cause us problems. Now, this seems silly, but this is this statement, this sentence, is a sentence that I use in a criminal justice class as I talk to kids about our Constitution. I ate with my dog fries. I'll ask you, what does that mean? Anybody?
Your dog's name is Fries, and you had dinner.
That's one way you could read that. What else? What, how else could I read it?
I ate fries with my dog.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Sat and ate.
French fries, and I sat and I ate with my dog. Could I have also eaten my dog?
Yep.
Okay. So punctuation matters. Word choices. Word choices really matter. And that's why, I mean, our Constitution was written a long time ago, and we're still trying to figure out what it means. And you have to go and you have to look at the intent. And if you look at the Constitution, you're studying the Constitution, you look at the Federalist Papers, you look at the Anti-Federalist Papers. You're trying to figure out what were these people thinking as they did this. Each of these bills has language in it that talks about what their intent is. And their intent on 1310, which is probably the most difficult one for us, is to address excessive force and discriminatory policing. So the assumption we can make is that the legislation believes that we're routinely using excessive force and discriminating against our community. I would disagree. Now, as we keep going with this, RCW 9A16020 talks about when is it permissible to use force? When can a citizen use force? When can a police officer use force? Those are built into 9A16020. Now, those provided a defense. So if as part of my job as a police officer, I used force, I would be I would have a defense as I'm being charged with a crime. So would a citizen. If they protect themselves, there's a defense built into this RCW, and that would they say, hey, it was self-defense, right here. Now, the assumption is, without that, any actions that the officer takes outside of this, because this is rewritten, wouldn't just be a civil issue where you sue the officer, it might actually be a crime if the officer were to use force outside of the rules that the legislation has created. Now, so as we keep going here, this is the biggest statement of House Bill 1310. Peace officers, and it doesn't say whether they're on duty or off duty. That's concerning. Peace officers may use physical force against a person when necessary, and it implies only when there's probable cause to make an arrest, to effect an arrest, to prevent an escape, to protect against an imminent threat of bodily injury to the officer, others, or the person force is being used against. I'm going to break each one of these down real quick because it's really important now. It talked about probable cause. Our police officers learn early in the academy what probable cause is. And we memorize it because we have to know what it means. But it's facts and circumstances within an officer's mind that would cause a reasonable person to believe that a crime, and it's a specific crime, has been committed. So it has to be a crime. So it has to be specific to a person. And the facts and circumstances must be known to the officer at the time of the arrest. So, and then, I mean, obviously this is, like I just said, it's a Fourth Amendment protection. Now, the Supreme Court discussed that in Terry versus Ohio, and they made an exception for us. We can temporarily detain somebody, and it's called a Terry stop, when we have reasonable suspicion that they're involved in criminal activity. So not a crime, but criminal activity. So this is called a Terry stop. And it's based on, again, reasonable suspicion. Reasonable suspicion is an objectively justifiable suspicion that is based on specific facts or circumstances that a person is thought to be involved in criminal activity at the time. Now, I don't want to get too far into this, but those two, probable cause, reasonable suspicion is not listed here as one of the reasons I can use force to stop somebody. Washington State is now the only state in our nation that does not allow a police officer to physically detain somebody based on reasonable suspicion. That's significant. I would say that's probably, Terry stops are arguably the most important investigative tool we had to do our jobs. And you'll see how and why in a minute. So what's the difference? Probable cause requires the officer believe a person, a specific person, did a specific crime. Reasonable suspicion requires the officer suspect a person is involved in criminal activity. So I suspect criminal activity, could, it's like they're peeking in windows. Could that be criminal activity? Yeah. Probable cause means they broke into the car, I saw the and you saw the person do it, and you conveyed that to me, or I saw them do it, specifically. Big difference here. Now, they talked about then, when else can I use it? To prevent an escape. Now, the escape is from custody, but primarily from like a detention facility. They're escaping from our jail, prison, Coyote Ridge, can't prevent people from escaping. But it doesn't mean I can prevent them from a Terry stop. Terry allowed me to temporarily detain somebody I suspected of criminal activity and identify them and pat them down for weapons. But the identify them is extremely important, and the ability to temporarily detain them while I build probable cause. We're not going to be able to do that now. Now, then they talked about imminent. I can use it to protect against an imminent threat. Now, the problem is the legislators built it all, or kind of mixed some of this together, where they said, I can use force to protect someone against imminent threat of harm. And then they said, but if I'm using deadly force, I can protect them against imminent threat of harm. Imminent threat of harm and deadly force being, and then they explained, it's immediate. Would most of you consider imminent to be immediate? Okay, imminent being it's coming. I got
large. Oh, okay.
Imminent means it's coming. It's going to happen. The tidal wave is over me. It's going to come down. That's imminent. I'm standing under an avalanche. It's going to drop on me because it's already started. That's imminent. Now, but imminent wasn't immediate. They defined, then they confused everybody. So now there's two places imminence used, but to protect people to use deadly force or firearm, I need to believe that it's immediate, only immediate. So I'm gonna keep going here. In cases of deadly force, a peace officer may use deadly force against another person only when necessary to protect against an imminent threat of serious physical injury or death to the officer or another person. Imminent, and this is where they explain what they believe, what imminent means to them in this case, but this definition of imminent isn't the definition of imminent in the first part. So going back to I ate my French fries with my dog, where's the commas? What are the definitions? How is it being used? We're trying to, law enforcement across our state is trying to make sense of this. The Criminal Justice Academy has come out with a statement that they think is what they're going to teach is there's really two imminents now. One for physical harm, one for deadly harm. Now necessary, and again, each of these are going to have to be developed and figured out as we go. Necessary means that under the totality of the circumstances, I'm sorry, I need to get back up there. At the very top, it's only when necessary is when I can use deadly force. We've always looked at force as a continuum. If you raise a fist against me, can I use a fist to defend myself? Yes. You pick up a stick, can it hurt me? What's the next thing above that? We just kind of, okay, I can always go a little bit above what the threat is. But now we're saying only when necessary. Necessary means that under the totality of the circumstances, a reasonably effective alternative to the use of deadly force does not exist. The amount of force used was a reasonable and proportional response to the threat posed to the officer and others. There's no case law on any of this yet. So the courts over the next couple years are going to basically try the police officers to determine whether or not it was necessary. So could I have shot the gun out of the person's hand? Well, I sometimes shoot that good. Some of you in this room can probably shoot that good. But in a high stress, I mean, and I'll go back to an example. When I was an early police officer, I was on a domestic violence call. I walked in the door. The woman that was being assaulted pointed at the bathroom. I opened the bathroom door. My partner's right behind me. The guy comes at me with a knife 3 feet away. And it was a big kitchen knife. And he's coming down like this with it. Now, was it necessary for me to use force? Yes. Would shooting him have been reasonable? Maybe under these new laws. Because I didn't use my gun. I didn't have my gun in my hand. I kicked him, took him down to the ground, took the knife away, cuffed him, and while I was cuffing him, I accidentally hurt his arm. So did I use excessive force at that point? Because he didn't have a knife anymore. Under this new law, I would probably be looking at decertification for that. Wow. Now, as we keep going here, reasonable and proportional response. Okay, we try that every day. Now let's keep going. This is legal implications. Unwritten but implied, and this comes from our insurance company, may not routinely detain or handcuff individuals while conducting reasonable suspicion investigations. That's a Terry stop. So I can say, hey, please stop. They say, you know, screw you, and they keep walking. I cannot stop them. May need to obtain consent before patting someone down. may not routinely use force to contain the scene of an arrest. Let me explain what that means to us in a minute. And it must be an imminent threat of bodily injury before force can be used. Now, new and pre-existing legal requirements. The new one says we have to exhaust. If we're going to use deadly force, we have to exhaust all available and appropriate de-escalation tactics. Actually, this is for all force. I'm sorry. This isn't for deadly force. We're to exhaust all available and appropriate de-escalation tactics prior to using any force. Use the least amount of force necessary to overcome the resistance. Well, that's pretty normal for us. We try that now. Terminate the use of force as soon as the necessity for such force ends. That's reasonable. When possible, use less lethal alternatives before using deadly force. Okay, now we're getting into Monday night quarterbacking us. I walk up to a car. As soon as I walk up, the guy starts jumping out with a gun. Should I now start de-escalating? Hey, sir, I need you to... Is there anything I can reasonably do to get you to drop the gun and not shoot me? I mean, and we could walk through some of the verbal techniques that we teach our officers. Can I call for someone to bring a beanbag gun to disarm them? Well, probably not going to happen in time. But it talks about what's reasonable. I mean, they give it this... When possible, I have to do this. Now, make less lethal alternatives issued to the officer reasonably available for their use. Now, I'm not going to talk about the laws about the weapons at this meeting unless we have time, but I don't. But beanbag rounds, stuff like that, guns, were something we actually budgeted for this year. I put off buying them, and you'll understand why in just a minute. So de-escalation tactics. These are what the state is telling us our de-escalation tactics are. We must exhaust, when possible, prior to the use of force. Create physical distance by employing tactical repositioning and repositioning as often as necessary to maintain the benefit of distance and time and cover. Okay. We saw that, I think, over in a little town outside Alder, was it Alderwood or one of those? But basically, they had a crazy guy come out of his house with a baseball bat, destroyed all his windows, jumped up on top of the car, starts beating all the windows out of the car, jumping up and down. The officers basically babysat him until they could convince him to go back inside the house. So they, in the past, and they, he got no help from mental health. In the past, we would have detained him. Yes, we probably would have tased him. We would have got him in handcuffs and got him to the mental health professionals to be evaluated. That's not going to happen now. Designate one officer to communicate with the subject to lessen confusion. That's best we do that now. Calling for additional resources, crisis intervention team. The nearest crisis intervention team folks that I'm aware of are in Tri-Cities. Calling for backup officers, we do that. Taking as much time as necessary without the use of weapons or physical force, okay? As much time as necessary is now a legal requirement. Could we have to sit on a house for 3 or 4 days to make sure somebody doesn't come out of it because they're armed with a knife and they're making threats? Theoretically, yes. And then the last one, consider leaving the area if there's no threat of imminent harm and no crime has been committed or is about to be committed. So retreat, leave, and which, I mean, might not make things better. So other factors, we're supposed to consider all these factors as we consider whether we're going to use force. Now, interestingly, one of the steps they took is they said our policy, that any violation of our policy is now a crime. So policy used to be guidance to our officers. In this case, they wrote this bill so that once we have department policy that complies, now keeping in mind, we had to start following this on July 25. The Attorney General doesn't have to give his model policy until next year. But, so our department policy, if my officers violate department policy on any of this use of force, then it is a crime. Unless it's to protect life or the life of another person from an imminent threat. Now, WCAA also came out with some recommendations. Some cities are following these. I've crossed off the ones I can't follow. Now, this is from our insurance company saying you should consider not going to these types of calls anymore. Civil standbys. Man and a woman going through a difficult time, they separate, she wants to go get her clothes because she's moved out, or he wants to go get his clothes because he's moved out. Traditionally, we go stand by to make sure nobody causes any problems. They're saying we probably shouldn't be going to those anymore. Health and welfare checks. Hey, my mom's making threats to hurt herself. Can you go check on her? They're saying we probably shouldn't go to those anymore. Property crime. Your car gets broken into. We probably shouldn't go anymore. Public nuisance. Fireworks call next door. That's an infraction, not a crime. They're saying you should consider not going anymore. Assisting designated crisis responders, DCRs, are mental health professionals that are the ones that are dealing most closely with our mentally ill. And we'll talk about the impact on that a bit. But that we not assist them on pickup orders and stuff like that. And then consider leaving the scene if there's no cooperation, no crime in progress, or imminently likely to occur. So if the individual is just waving a knife around, there's nobody else around, and he walks back in his house after he makes a bunch of threats, we should probably just let it go. Consider using body cameras if not already used. Body cameras are our best friend now. We saw this coming with 940. Body cameras are really important. Liability considerations that WCAA suggested. Legislative mandates. There's a whole lot of conflicts with these new laws and existing laws. For example, domestic violence or a mandatory arrest. I have to, if I go to a domestic violence call, and I believe I have probable cause that somebody assaulted somebody else, I have to arrest somebody. Now, the conflict is with some of these is, what if the guy jumps in his car and flees? Traditionally, we would have chased him and caught him. Now we can't pursue. But do we have liability when we fail to enforce a statutory requirement? Yes, we do. So the liability's on us. Special relationships. Hey, so civil standby. I show up. I'm going to try to keep the peace. If I make any assurance that, hey, I'm going to keep the peace, and somebody gets hurt, I'm now more, and I couldn't step in time, because I can't use force until I have imminent. So I create liability there. The torts laws, they've made it much easier to sue police officers. In fact, they said that was their legislative intent, is to make it easier to personally sue police officers. Now, in most lawsuits, and I would say every single time I've been sued, or the city's been sued, I was sued too, but they immediately dropped me out because the city defended me. If the city chose not to defend me and they rule against me, then that domino is fallen. The city is going to fall next. So it's in our interest to defend our police officers unless they've done wrong. And so they've made it easier to sue that officer, which means it's going to be easier to sue cities.
So if you can't pursue, that means that person's going to get away with it? You can't go apprehend them later?
Councilman Garza, I can go back later and find them, but they're going to get away with it then. So we're not going to give up, and that's a message you're going to hear from me. And then the officer affirmatively acts and exposes a person to greater danger. So we acted versus not acting. So I tased the person when I shouldn't have, but I saved his life. So he sues me for it. That's how some of that could play out. Now, the model policy the Attorney General is supposed to come out with, once that's done, all city policies for use of force have to be approved by the Attorney General, and then they cannot be changed unless the Attorney General blesses it. So let's walk through just some simple calls. Domestic violence call. This is a routine call for us, folks. 911 receives a call from neighbors about screaming and yelling at a home. The caller indicates they believe a man is assaulting his girlfriend. Officers are dispatched and they arrive. Previously, once we arrive, we listen for a minute, we try to make sure it's not a TV, because I've been to those calls when it's a TV, and the screaming and yelling is on the TV. We listen for a minute, we knock on the door, somebody comes to the door. Sir, we heard some yelling, I want to make sure you and your wife are both okay. Is anybody else here? No. Okay, that's routine. Well, I need a check. Let me see your wife, please. And then once we walk in, the wife's hiding in another room, we separate them. At this point, keep in mind, that's a reasonable suspicion. I'm using force to separate them to keep him from going after her, but also to keep them apart while I talk to each one separately. Because I don't have probable cause yet. Then I have to ask, both parties, were you assaulted? Did he or she touch you, in any way, threaten you in any way? We investigate. And then if it's a mandatory, or we find someone was at fault, we make that arrest, and we don't have to go back later. That law was enacted because we were going back numerous times. People were dying because cops weren't arresting someone. Now, same kind of call. Cop's going to knock on the door. Man comes to the door. Sir, everybody okay here? Yep, don't need you here. Go away. Can I see your wife? Girlfriend? Nope. We're going to leave.
And somebody's going to die.
And someone could die. We might stand outside for a bit, listen. But without reasonable suspicion, being able to actually do the investigation, temporarily detain people while we're doing it, the result is we have to wait till there's an imminent threat, or we have to wait till we have probable cause for a specific crime.
That's going to tie into, I don't know if we deal with it, but child abduction cases?
I've got a whole list for you.
Fair enough. Go ahead, sir.
Shooting investigations. Now, this is a routine. Where I came from, this was very common. Here it's not, but we're seeing some more of it. Officers are dispatched to report a shots fired. When they arrive, they see an individual on the ground bleeding. Three rival gang members run from the scene. Previously, we would have detained those three rival gang members, patted them down and identified them, probably got the gun that one of them had, taken statements, made sure they didn't have time to exchange stories, and we've prevented anything from continuing. New law, officers arrive at this call, they see the individual on the ground bleeding, they see the three running away, they have no probable cause for a specific person who shot. We're going to have to let them go. Now, we may not find them again. But without probable cause, we can't detain. We can say, please stop. If they don't, I can use no force to stop them. There is no exception in those four conditions the state gave us. Let's take a mental health call. MHP, the health professional, calls, says an individual stopped taking meds, refuses meetings, and is making threatening statements. They have signed a pickup order. Now, a pickup order is not generally signed by a judge, but they can be, even if it's signed by a judge. Is it any one of those four conditions where I can use force? Probable cause to arrest somebody for a crime? To effect an arrest? Well, that's not an arrest. Prevent an escape? Well, they aren't in custody, they can't escape. And the fourth was imminent harm. Is there an imminent threat of harm for someone that's, say, making threats and MHP calls me and says, oh, go pick them up, or gives me a pickup order? The answer is no. There is no way we can go pick them up. So let's keep going here. Less serious but relevant. Actually, I'll say that last one is serious. But civil violations. Othello is a code city with all of our crimes being civil infractions. Besides that, we have to use state law for crimes. So a violation in our park, urinating in public, loud music, fireworks, those are all civil infractions. They are not probable cause of a crime. I can use no force in any way to detain somebody while I'm investigating that or charging them. Park rule violations, after hours, those kind of things. Suspicious person. Suspicious person in the park playing with themselves, touching themselves inappropriately in front of the kids. Is it a crime? No. Not unless they're exposed.
How about not a crime?
If it's under their clothing, it's not indecent exposure. So we can't go in, it would be indecent exposure if it was outside of the clothing and we could show their intent. But I show up, I've got the nasty person, you know, touching themselves, and I say, sir, I need your name. Screw you, I'm leaving. I can't stop them. Might be a registered sex offender, I can't stop them. I have no probable cause of a crime. Juveniles with narcotics. So you all saw what the state did with narcotics with the Blake decision, where the Supreme Court ruled that because the word knowingly wasn't in our drug cases, well, now possession of drugs, any type of drugs, I don't want to get too far because that's actually one of the next ones, but say a kid at school has a pound of fentanyl. I can take it from him. I can't use force. I have to make two referrals on them before I can criminally charge them, because it's not a crime until there's two referrals. On the third one, I can charge them. Runaways. State law says we have to pick them up. They're entered in the system. If they're in the system, I have to pick them up. Harboring a runaway is a crime, but I can't use any force. And I look back, how many runaways have I detained that said, oh yeah, I want to go home now? They don't. So we can't use force to detain a runaway. We're going to have a lot of runaways in our system because we're not going to be able to pick them up. Suicidal persons. I mean, we deal with mentally ill, and I believe suicide is often mental illness. It's not always. But we get a suicidal person call. We're not going to force entry into their home to check on them. That's a big paradigm shift for many of us. Consequences. So, without the defenses available under RCW, any use of force not authorized could be a crime. Any use of force not authorized by 1310 would increase civil liability. Any use of force not authorized by 1310 would be grounds for decertification. It is one of the decertification. We'll touch on that bill too. Officers will spend significantly more time writing reports when force is used. CYA. They want to make sure they're not going to get decertified. They're not going to go to jail because they used force. And the lawsuit, well, we assume we're going to be sued. Officers, what previously took off a few officers will now take longer and may escalate before officers can take action. So before I came here, a couple years, this case is gone now, but I can discuss it. A few years ago, 10 years ago, we had a man standing in an intersection three blocks from our middle school shooting a gun in the air, standing in the middle of an intersection. Officers showed up. If that man hadn't brought the gun down and pointed it at an officer, because at that point the officer shot him and killed him. School was 5 minutes from being let out. So we would have had 800 kids potentially coming towards our scene. If that man kept the gun pointing in the air or was pointing at the ground shooting it, do I have probable cause for an arrest? Yes, I do. Do I have imminent? Yes, I do. But I have to go through all those de-escalation rules, which include leaving, which include taking as much time as necessary. Now, when I look at what that would take, if I had 20 or 30 police officers, which we don't and I didn't then, we can block off all the streets, start evacuating people, make sure that he can't go anywhere, you know, block, surround all the streets. But we're not going to have those options available most of the time. But we're going to have to try to find more on a lot of these cases. So consequences, decertification to be covered, and I'll talk about that. One of the bills was a pretty significant rewrite of the state certification of a police officer. I lose my certification, it's like a doctor losing his license. I can't perform this job anymore. Office of Independent Investigations, so that was another one of these bills. So now when an officer uses deadly force, they're going to have an Office of Independent Investigations to come investigate the crime scene. If they want to, they could allow CBIT to continue, but they may not. State audit. So the state auditors aren't just going to be auditing our finances now. They would actually audit our use of force in that condition to make sure that we followed the law and policy. So, questions?
Nothing like letting a CPA determine whether or not you're using force correctly. I had a quick question.
Three parts to this. Second, I'm sorry, sir.
Yeah, go ahead.
Three parts to this. The next one I'll cover a greater chunk of these laws. 1310 is probably the most significant. I wanted you guys to hear it because it affects so much of what we do. And on part three, the last day when I present to you, I've got some recommendations and some. There's no solutions that I'm going to be happy with. But we are going to continue providing law enforcement as absolutely best we can to protect our community. We love our community. This is a great, great town. We've got some obstacles in front of us. We're going to do our best. Sir.
So I had a couple questions. And I don't know that they'll be answered, but maybe something you're... I'm going to pick... Does the immediate and imminent topic apply to normal citizens?
No.
Okay. property crime and how it relates to insurance claims. I know you're not an attorney, or are you an insurance agent? But a lot of people that have theft out of the car have to get a police report to file for an insurance claim. And you had mentioned earlier that OPD probably wouldn't be responding to those.
We will continue to respond. Okay. The ones I crossed out, we're not going to take our insurance company's advice on those.
Okay.
Our community expects us to come to many types of these crimes that the bigger cities already don't. But what makes Othello is the fact that we serve, and we're going to keep coming to those.
And the last one I have, and I appreciate that clarification, because that one worried me. There's a lot of things that, as a citizen, we depend on our police force to come to help us move forward through the processes of whatever it may be, but it's a big tool. DUIs, reasonable suspicion versus probable cause. And you say the most times you're pulling someone over for a DUI, it's because they were swerving. That's kind of a reasonable suspicion.
That is a reasonable. All traffic violations begin with reasonable suspicion.
Yes.
All violations. So the pursuit laws allow Mothers Against Drunk Drivers obviously have better lobbyists than WASPIC did, because we can still pursue when we have reasonable suspicion of a DUI. But
don't those usually get violent?
That's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
But traffic stops, fail to stop at a stop sign, speeding through town, racing, those kind of things. We cannot pursue on those. We're going to get into the list of those.
But you can attempt to stop. If they run,
we can turn on our lights. If they run, they're going to go.
We need Batman.
I've got a Batman shirt.
Okay.
So House Bill 5038. That's where it's unlawful to carry a weapon into all these restricted areas.
You're talking, and I'll be covering that one on part three.
But it also says, if you keep reading and read carefully, it also says that in item E, nothing in this subsection applies to the lawful concealed carry of a firearm by a person who has a valid concealed pistol license.
The legislature on that bill was trying to prevent open carry. Concealed carry can still continue, but what they're trying to say is, for example, if it's a Second Amendment march where there's open carry, that an individual would not be. Currently, if I wanted to walk to Walmart from here with an AR-15 across my back, I could. That's open carry. If I concealed it, I would need a concealed pistol or concealed weapons license.
But who's going to enforce that? Because under the restrictions that you just imposed, you can't stop that individual because there's no imminent threat.
Well, or probable cause of an arrest, or probable cause for a crime.
So how can you enforce that law?
It's another of the conflictions. The legislature basically says if there's an event going on, a registered or permitted event, and someone is open carrying a gun, that the law enforcement officer could go and say, hey, there's this event, you need to leave. If that person then says, no, I'm not going to, they'd be in violation, and we could theoretically use force to arrest them. I'm going to get into a lot more detail on that one. And it does apply to us, because even though it's titled Capitol Building, I think, it applies to local protests. If the city has issued a permit for a protest, there cannot be open carry in it within 250 feet.
I know you're going to get into detail on this, Chief, but that's a scary one. So it really is.
Which one isn't?
That's a scary one, because I know that we had a planned protest that went very smoothly, respectfully, cleanly here locally. But I can also tell you there were people sitting and ready to defend properties, because it was during that heightened awareness and lots of destruction with Antifa and BLM.
Yep.
Those people sitting ready to defend their property are now in violation, or do you have to be a participant of the licensed event? Because technically you are participating by, if that event comes to your front door, you're now a participant. I don't know.
The way I would interpret that, open carry applies to a public place. If you're in your business, protecting your business, then having a firearm not concealed would be legal as long as you can legally possess that firearm.
And it does specifically say that in there too, in that law.
Does the city need to prepare to have extra liability insurance to protect our officers?
It's a consideration that I was going to bring to council, or to the mayor.
And another lawyer, huh?
Maybe twice as much would be fine.
Oh, we get dope. Oh, yeah.
Just joking.
I can't even say.
We can handle it.
I've talked to lawyers that have mentioned they think these new bills are going to make them rich.
And you're going to find every ambulance chaser out there that's going to take advantage of it, and people like
I think more people within the community need to know what this is going to be for them, what it means to them. I mean, this needs to go out to the churches, to where it can be openly spoke about, where we have large gatherings of people, because it's going to change how we have always, if you you have a problem, you call the cops. Well, the cops are going to tell you, I can't come.
I didn't want to start putting that out on social media until I actually briefed council. One of the concerns that I've heard from people is we don't want to educate people that are going to do bad. But the people that are going to do bad, I'm just going to say this, they're going to do bad anyways, and they knew this stuff before you did. When we go trying to stop most of these 14-year-old problems that are going around shooting and spray painting our town, and we say, hey, stop, the answer is F you as they walk away. And they're 13 and 14-year-olds. So they're being educated. We need to educate you and our community of what this looks like, but I want you to hear what our recommendations are too and what we can do about it. And I don't want to give you the script, but block watches are going to be a huge piece of it.
I mean, we don't physically have gatherings that are in our neighborhood, but everybody in our neighborhood watches the other person's property and possessions. And
we can get educated, but they're going to get educated too, to the point to, hey, they can't chase me anyway.
Well, and I think it's important. I think it's important, Chief, if there's going to be a continued OPD presence to deter criminals from, and you're going to do as much as you can. I think it's important that the public knows that we're not just throwing our hands up in the air in defeat, that OPD and Chief and its staff is going to continue to push very hard to deter these criminals. Because I don't think anybody wants these criminals, or to feel like we're just going to give it up to Joker and his gang, and OPD is going to just sit back and say, I can't do nothing. And I don't think that's the intent.
That is not our intent. In fact, I mean, as part of one of our recommendations is in educating our public needs to know that they have self-defense rights. They have the ability to detain somebody that breaks into their house.
And that's scary in and of itself.
Where sometimes, I mean, others don't. I mean, in fact, the citizens' rights haven't been damaged in this case. This was targeted towards the police.
Vigilantism, once the public realizes that it is more effective than the police department, bye-bye police department. Yep. If the police department does not remain and laws do change back, but the public has already taken care of the problem effectively, good luck, police department, regaining control. that's a very, very slippery slope that we're on with this vigilantism. And
very much agree.
And the poor people protecting their family, their loved ones, their neighbors, or their own property or life are going to be victimized by this left-wing nut sitting in the governor's office and his watchdog attorney. And there, because you can win a court case here, but the farther west you go, the less you're going to have. This is crazy.
And the other concern with the vigilantes, you defend yourself. You maybe have legally have done it, but you better be able to hire an attorney.
Yeah.
And many of the folks that want to protect themselves will not be able to afford to hire.
Exactly. Killing the bad guy or maiming the bad guy is the small threat. That's the easy threat to deal with. Dealing with Ferguson, because if he decides to come after you, he's going to appeal it. So you're going to leave Ritzville, and you're going to head that way. And the farther you go that way, the less of a chance you have of winning, unless you got some deep pockets. And there's not very many deep pockets in this town.
Any more questions, Council?
Chief, I want to thank you for this first part of introduction. And I think, too, it's equally as important to let the citizens know what they can do as much as what the police officers can, because I think that is going to, as we go forward, we want to know what we can do.
Sure.
And block watches are a part of it, but there's going to be other things that we can do, and believe me, we will do them. So let's now move, going to move to item 4D&E. We're going to move into an executive session. That executive session, I anticipate, will last 30 minutes at the most, and I'd like all the staff to remain. So if staff would prepare the council chambers for executive session, we'll go into executive session at 8:07 p.m. Yeah. You need to take a break. Okay, we're ready? All right, we're coming back into session at 8:52 p.m. And we'll move now to unfinished business, item 5. Does the City Council have any unfinished business? Okay, you asked me about the weeds at Avista, so I called Ian, and they are hiring a contractor to come in, and they're going to mow the weeds down and weed eat, so they're going to get on it. I don't have any more unfinished business.
I was going to give it a little bit of time, but there is just that I had requested what it would take to put handicap parking spaces in Kiwanis, and didn't know if we'd chase that down yet. That's something I could expect to be a few weeks out, so I don't keep bringing it up. And I'm sure there's more than just a paint can and a couple symbols. I'm sure there's going to be, you know, curb ramps and things like that that get involved. So
I think there are curb spaces that do go into the sidewalk, but we'll go down there and check that out.
Yeah.
Okay. I've got that down. Any other unfinished business, Council? How about some new business? Does anybody have any new business tonight?
I know the our church has wanted to do something for the city, mm-hmm. you know, in certain, you know, areas. So we had talked about, and when we got together with Scott, about some stripe curb painting, remember, in certain areas. So I was going to concentrate in talking to the church about that, because that's Sage Stone, the fire hydrants, there's no paint there, but there's cars parking there. And Snyder. Yeah, he made us aware of that, and we need to clear that up. We'll make sure that the fire trucks can get a fire hose there. So I'll talk to the guy that's in front of that, and maybe we can do that. Some of it, anyway.
That's really nice. Thank you.
When they mentioned that, did I know where to go with that?
Okay.
I actually had a question for Chief. On the block, you know what? I'll reserve that for another meeting. I'll reserve that on new business.
Okay. The city had purchased a couple of years ago some property from Tom and Sarah Salisbury up by well number 9. And there was 5 acres there, and there was a holdback agreement on that of $15,000 if we were able to get the Bureau of Reclamation to mitigate those drain lines. We're not able to get the Bureau of Reclamation to mitigate those drain lines, and that time frame expires in September. And so I'm just letting the council know that that $15,000 is going to be released to the Salisbury's.
It's not coming out of, it's money that's currently in trust and not in the city's, but I mean, not in the city's account right now anyway. I mean, so it's not as if the city's going to be paying an additional $15,000. It's just that we're not going to get that back out of trust.
Yeah, that was going to go towards the mitigation of those drain lines. It was going to improve the value of his property too, but we were unable to do that. So we had a time frame on that, and that's expiring. So I'm just letting the city council know the outcome of that transaction. Is there any other new business tonight, council? Then we'll move to item 7. There is no department head reports. So having no further business, I'll conclude tonight's meeting at 8:57 p.m.